Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Seaweed Brain. Last week, we began our conversation about the score for the TV show, and we are going to be continuing that conversation this week. We have the same very special guest. Stick around.
Yay, welcome back, everybody. This is part two of our music conversation. If you want to hear all of the rambling about our histories with music, you can go to our first conversation from last week. I'm Erica, as always, joined by my co-host Carter.
Hi.
And we have Jay Maya back in the house to join us for the rest of this conversation. What is up?
Not much. Just chatting music and Percy Jackson. And like I said, those are my two favorite things in the world. So I'm very happy.
Yeehaw! All right. We left off at the end of last week talking about Percy's theme. We were sort of going through Bear McCreary's blog post from his website, bearmccreary.com, and talking about the individual themes that are laid out in season one, because this man is incredible and he wrote individual themes for characters, which is something you wouldn't usually do in a TV show. You would usually do that in a movie. But we do not hold back for Percy Jackson. And I think what we need to do now is talk about Annabeth. So I'm going to read a little quote from the Bear blog post here about Annabeth. For most of season one, Annabeth is reserved, serious, and even cold toward Percy. With each episode, she opens up more, and by the end of the season, she has a deep bond with Percy. For Annabeth, Bear wrote a theme that begins understated and subtle, but expands into an eventual, soaring, romantic, even heroic melody. Annabeth's theme does not appear in its full orchestral glory for the first season of Percy Jackson. However, Bear nicely foreshadows what her music might sound like in subsequent seasons in his rousing end credits suite, which we have been referring to as the, in heavy quotation marks, overture.
Oh, Annabeth. What really strikes me in that paragraph is the use of the word romantic, because I love that. Her theme is very romantic.
It's
strong, it's heroic. And I just love that that is the word to describe her character, because I think sometimes in media there exists this binary that like strong women can also be hopeless romantics and you have to like pick one or the other. And I love that what Annabeth, her character, has done to kind of go against this binary, and then to have this reflected also in her musical score, that it's so dynamic and it shows all of the different facets of her character, I think really just goes to show like what phenomenal representation she is for a strong female character in a YA novel and TV adaptation. So yeah, I just loved that part of it.
Bringing back strong girls who are also like romantically hopelessly like, you know, in love with the world around them and their friends and maybe their romantic interests, like that's so important. And we talked I keep referencing back to our Patreon conversations, not only as a way to plug our Patreon, but because I feel like it's part of our like understanding of media right now. Like we talked a lot about this with the Little Mermaid movie, where it was so refreshing to see like a female main character who, yes, she is strong and she is smart, but she's also like, she's in love and she's experiencing all these things for the first time. And she's like, she's not perfect and she's not doing everything right, you know? Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's what we get from this Annabeth theme.
Yeah.
Carter, you say something here about cellos?
Yeah.
I'm just looking at your notes.
As we were going through this and preparing for this, I did note to myself, if we were to say that one thing about this score is a bit of a stereotype, it is that Annabeth's theme begins with cellos.
Do you think Annabeth would be a cello player? Is that why you're saying it's a stereotype?
I think in the year, like in any year from like 2010 through 2024, yes. Annabeth, if she were like enrolled in a middle school and or high school, would probably be a cello player. Yeah, I stand by that.
Wow. Do you want to speak more on like why that's a filthy read of cello players, Carter?
The thing about cello players from the year 2010 on is that there's so many of them. You know, like they're numerous and they're constantly carrying around these gigantic things that they could use to like hit you with. You know, like it's basically a weapon with them all the time. So that's a little bit scary as well. But
Carter, were you getting beat up by cello players in middle school?
I feel like emotionally I was, but it's okay because I held my ground. We understood our respective roles in the ensemble and also in life. Wow, I don't have something complicated to say. It's like a post Yo-Yo Ma moment. It is like the thing that like if you were trying to be a child who does something melodic and serious, it's a cello. Like the day of the violin is gone. And now the roles have kind of reversed, where violinists these days are kind of like kooky and cellists are straight edge and serious and trying to be like virtuosic soloist oriented people. That's my take.
Which is very Annabeth.
Yeah. Annabeth would not be like, oh, I need to like play some like flighty, like Tchaikovsky rep or something. No, she's going to drill down and be like, this is the instrument of the moment and I will be the best.
Also, the description of using a cello as a weapon, it makes me think like
she would.
And you know what? Annabeth's good with a bow. We know she's good with, so why not two kinds of bows? You know what I mean? but I feel like I love the kind of analysis of her and what we were saying about the theme being romantic. I feel like this theme really, to me, connotes longing. Along with something, and also with the use of the suspended chords, like that's a very common way that composers can demonstrate longing in a piece, is with suspension. And her theme is the only of the trio to use suspended chords, and I think what that makes me think of is like opportunities to expand on that in the next season. And something we were talking about earlier was this melding of diegetic music and non-diegetic music. A scene that I think I'm really looking forward to seeing how they score is the siren scene in The Sea of Monsters. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, I felt that in my soul. And I wonder if this is almost like foreshadowing some of those moments with Annabeth that we see as the reader throughout the series. Like, Annabeth has so many moments of longing. Obviously, the siren scene is like the hallmark of that. But, you know, moments with her family, moments, you know, where we see her alone at Camp Half-Blood, like, again, talking about this idea of Annabeth being this multifaceted woman. Like, she is scared to be vulnerable, but learns to open up throughout the series. That is, like, the beauty of her and Percy's relationship. And I see this almost reflected in the score, this, like, heroic, you know, these moments of heroism and open, sweeping chords, and then back to this, like, sheltered longing with the violins. And it makes me think about how they're going to approach some of these really pivotal emotional moments for her in the next season.
That's amazing. I really hope that they specifically, repurpose this for the siren song, but specifically only do the, like, unresolved, uptrending pieces of melody and just, like, cut it repeatedly at those places. So it's just like rising tension, wandering in suspension, and just like a growing chorus of this.
She's looking at Olympus built in her own image. To go back to Haley's question from last week, when would you guys want to hear like the fully developed Annabeth theme that is being reserved?
This might be like going forward, but there is like seeing her hold the sky.
That's what I was going to say.
Oh, yeah.
Mind melt.
Is it in a dream where he first sees her?
It's in a dream when she takes it from Luke.
Oh my God. I can just see this epic shot where like we're panning upwards from the ground and it's like just on her feet. And then we like see her in like her full glory as she's like lifting up the entire sky, you know? And that's when like she like looks up and makes eye contact with the camera. And that's when we get the full theme for the first time.
I'm with you.
Because that is a moment that really represents that duality of Annabeth, where like she is there and she's like so strong, she's so fierce, and she's doing this thing. But why is she doing it? Mm. It's because she took it from Luke. She took the weight from Luke. And like that is the like vulnerability and the longing that is also inside of her.
Yeah.
Chill.
This theme is so beautiful. There's the suspension, but there's also this, when you compare it to Percy's theme, Percy's theme is generally like ascending straight rhythms. It's a lot of like half notes, whole notes coming down on like the ones and the threes. Whereas Annabeth's theme has a lot of these like rhythmic changes where you get the beginnings of not exactly syncopation, but like pick up lead ins into the next phrase. You get melodies that rise and then fall within the same phrase, and like a much more of like a traditional classical lyrical melody with like a shape you can see in the paper. And I think it's very appropriate for her. The cello thing is making me think about the meta narrative of this, which is that like I think that Annabeth's theme in a lot of ways is the most plainly in line with a old classical tradition of
yeah
music.
I know what you mean,
but
yeah,
it is simultaneously the theme that I think is the most vulnerable and emotional. And that also to me really speaks to the idea of Annabeth, that like if you're not listening very closely, you might find this her theme to be the most rigid, or people would bring a lot of preconceptions about the stodginess or uninventiveness or the like lack of emotionality of the theme if you're not like really looking at it closely and realizing that this theme holds the most like uncertainty and the most movement out of all of the three of them that we've gotten so far. And I think that is Annabeth's story in a lot of ways.
I'm really following you on that. Yeah, I agree.
Oh, Annabeth, the girl that you are. And speaking of her incredible capacity for character depth, one final moment that I will say in terms of like where I think I would love to hear her theme expressed is when she's presented with the choice to join the Hunters.
Yeah.
I just think that that's like a moment of suspension. That's like a moment of, oh my gosh, is she going to do this? Is what she could totally do this. Is this what she's going to do? And maybe this is a moment where her theme melds with Percy's theme. Oh my God, I'm getting ahead of myself. But...
oh, the Titan's curse.
It's a moment of suspension. It's a moment of curiosity. I think Adam's theme is so curious. That's the other word I would use to describe it. I think that's a Little Mermaid of it all as well. Like, we need to bring back specifically girls who, the way that we understand intelligence is not just like an ability to create product, to execute goals, but, you know, like first to value curiosity and the idea that like a mark of intelligence that we're valuing in women is for them to pursue their own ends and to active self-serving minds as well as public serving minds, you know?
And the innate curiosity and hyperfixation is so important for Annabeth. I'm thinking about the opening of the Tunnel of Love sequence when they're like trying to get through the gate and she's like, this is so interesting. Like studying the trap as Percy is like, can you get me out of here?
Yeah, she is of the trio the most inquisitive and the most, I mean, that's her character. She's inventive. She thinks outside of the box. I think that's a great way to put her character, is curious.
Yeah. Should we talk about Grover's theme? This is what was written in the article. Quote, his first interval, that of a tritone, makes his melody instantly recognizable. His theme is often heard on a lilting flute, a subtle reference to mythological satyrs and their iconic pan flute. Indeed, we snuck some moments of pan flute into the score that are meant to tee up musical arcs for this character in future seasons. I didn't even notice it was a tritone. Speaking of West Side Story, the most famous tritone in all of Western music. Maria.
I had no idea either. And I think that's such an unusual, but I mean, fitting, still strangely fitting choice for Grover to start with a tritone.
Can you do an explanatory comma on the tritone for the listeners who might not know what the interval is referring to? Or what an interval is, maybe.
It's the devil's triad?
The devil's interval.
The devil's interval. I love that. Yeah, not the devil's triad. It is fitting, though, because... like, obviously, you know, there's devil evil. There is devil playful. Like, Grover's, he's having fun. But that aside, personality aside, what it often demonstrates is a sense of foreboding. Like, oh my gosh, like, something is about to happen. And Grover
is... he's an anxious king.
An anxious king.
Anxiety. That's it.
Of my mouth. Like, you can look at Grover in any situation, and he is, like, he is stressed.
He's having his tummy ache.
It makes me think about something that I saw Bear write about Grover's theme in the blog post, which is that Grover's theme has a very unusual chord change in it, like something that feels, the word he uses is quirky, but it's surprising. His theme has chord progressions that are not very intuitive, let's say, to like the untrained ear. Mm-hmm. And I thought that that was a really interesting description of it, because Grover is also not intuitive to the mimicism personality. And the last thing that I think comes to mind about this score is about the pan flute. This is a perfect opportunity for diegetic music to take flight in future seasons. Like, I would love to see Grover play his own theme and then have that, you know, go into an orchestral version of a theme that brings us into the next scene or something as a transition. So, and I just love that the theme feels as playful and as dynamic as he is as a character, because that's, I think, underrated for Grover's character. He has a lot of depth to him that is not often, you know, celebrated.
Yeah, I think the other thing about the tritone of it all, and also the like unexpected chord progressions, is that Grover is like the most fantastical of the main characters. Yes. He is a satyr and he comes from a world that is very different from both of them. And we get to see a little bit of that with his Council of Cloven Elders thing and how he's mm-hmm. going to go off in search for Pan. He is like separate from them in that way, that he exists in the, like, the natural world. And also like what we talked about in season one, where he represents a different ideological pillar to Annabeth and Luke, where he like, he thinks about things very differently, Manifest Destiny in the St. Louis Arch. And I think when
Grover also doesn't really pass in the human world in the way that the other, the demigods can.
That's so true. Yeah, he has to have his little hat on. The mist has to obscure his legs. And like, when we say like the devil's chord, like a lot of things that are called like devilish or evil, that's because it's like different from the norm, right? Mm-hmm. It's like not Christian and therefore it is like the devil.
Common in pagan music.
Yeah, it just, the tritone to us sounds different. It sounds unique. And that is what Grover is. He like represents a different, unique perspective on every situation.
The other big thing that I think people use the tritone for is as a source of tension, because the tritone is this interval, like if your first note is C, as it is in the case of Grover's theme, the tritone is going to be the F sharp, which is the note that is exactly in between the two octave things. It's like equidistant from the lower C and the higher C, which to your ear, like it creates this feeling of being the most lost. Like you need to go somewhere else. And that sense
he's trying to find Pan.
Holsten. Yeah, that unease in the current position, I think, is very appropriate. Yeah, Grover has places to be that are not where he is right now. And there's an unease. It's not just that he's like in a place and he's going to the next place. It's that the place he's in is not right. That there's something askew. And that not necessarily that it's wrong for him to be there, but that we need to immediately move on. Like there are things to do.
Yeah.
I was just thinking about how, wow, wouldn't it be interesting if when Grover finds Pan in book four, like there is a version of his melody, his theme that's played where like the tritones have suddenly like been resolved. But at the same time, that wouldn't even be the right place to do that.
We just introduce them in other places.
Yeah.
It just like becomes like a tritone based chord structure.
Yeah, because it's still like Pan then disappears and then his life is again, once again, confusing and sad and he's still searching for something. So it wouldn't be until he like becomes, what is it called?
Self-actualized.
So yes, he self-actualizes, but he becomes a Cloven Elder himself. Yeah.
Yeah. I love everything you just said about his searching nature.
A searcher.
He is a searcher. He canonically. But I think what you were saying about he's an anxious king, it starts with this foreboding tone, and especially what you said about a tritone signifying just something that is departing from the norm. What Grover represents to me as a reader is how bravery can look different for different people.
Mm-hmm.
Bravery can be you are not scared of something that you should be scared of. Bravery can also be you are terrified of something and you still choose to act and you still choose to not let it affect your actions. And to me, that is what Grover represents in this trio, and the fact that his, you know, theme starts with anxiety and then grows and builds into a heroic moment at the end. That feels very telling to his character. And then yeah. Also something that you said about how composers can wield non-traditional elements of music to show how a character is maybe different from the rest of the characters in the show. It reminds me a lot of the music in the tracks Auntie M and Lord of the Dead, because those are two examples of how Barry McCreary and Sparks and Shadows use atypical modalities. They use atypical instrumentation to basically show that Medusa and Hades are in this weird sonic world, two sides of the same coin, in the sense that they are departures from the rest of the Olympians. They are out.
Yes.
They are different.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's such a interesting way to look at how the music is used in the series, is like to show how subconsciously, even, right, as it's not like explicated as clearly as dialogue, but it is demonstrated through the music that these characters are so different and are treated as such by the other characters and treated by the show as well. So yeah, I just thought that was a really good point.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I think that's a great time to transition into just like some other tracks that we want to talk about. This is again from the article, quote, "Our core characters were represented by orchestral colors. So it made sense to all of us to use non-orchestral instruments to represent the otherworldly aspects of the series. Each stop on Percy's journey across America and eventually to other realms required a new musical color." And they go on to talk about how like one of the central instruments of Camp Half-Blood was, I don't know if I'm going to say this right, duduk, an Armenian instrument, which is really interesting. They also use that instrument for the Auntie M piece. Carter, you had some interesting notes here about Narnia.
Yeah, that was my immediate reaction when I first heard this. And specifically the things that I would point to in the instrumentation are the use of vocals, where it's not a choir. It's like an almost distorted singular vocalist. There's no lyrics, you know, and it's entering a sort of different mode, and that vocal is combined with specifically like drumline that is distorted and like not near the microphone, and chimes. I think these are all hallmarks that were used in the Chronicles of Narnia scoring as well, and the effect of all of them put together is, I don't know how much of this is because we like associate like non-Anglo-Saxon British Isles things as being kind of like otherworldly, but I think these are like easy signifiers for that, and specifically signifiers for a transition from the real world, the mundane world, however you'd want to refer to it, the mortal world, into something else that is immediately abutting it, but that we haven't been exposed to yet.
I think that that's a really astute point about just anything that departs from Western instruments being considered otherworldly, foreign. It does a good job of kind of demonstrating what parts of the series are kind of fantastical and foreign to the viewer. And I noted that about Camp Half-Blood as well, that the instruments are so kind of not in the sonic palette that we're used to. I also noticed that the chords were really open. There were choral elements, but listening to the other tracks in the soundtrack, sometimes the choral elements are much lower, so lower voices, tenors, and basses, and then sometimes there's sopranos and altos. And I loved that this piece used higher voices. I thought that that just kind of kept it light and open and magical sounding and flowery, as opposed to when there are like much lower bassy voices. And I loved all the movement in it too. It just felt very driving.
Yeah, I think the drums are also like specifically, especially because the first part that we spend in the series at Camp Half-Blood is like mostly capture the flag. And that is like the military sound. And then the blog post says, quote, when Percy returns to camp triumphant in the 8th episode, the theme reappears, but now in a more sentimental form, missing the militaristic percussion. And even though his time at camp was relatively brief, this wistful statement in the season finale helps the audience to understand he feels like he's coming home, end quote. And that I think is so important, because that is such a great storytelling device, you know, filmmaking device, for the fact that we do spend so little time at Camp Half-Blood. And we talked a lot in our analysis episodes about how do you make it feel like you've spent an adequate amount of time there and that that is your home. The music is such an easy way to do that. You know, first of all, the gorgeous lighting of when they're like saying goodbye to Camp Half-Blood, you know, and they're all hugging at the tree, that really helps. But then you have to add in that music and that sentimental theme. So even if you only heard that theme one time, 6 episodes ago, the way that you do the instrumentation, creating that sentimental nostalgic sound, will make us feel like, oh my God, yeah, they're leaving camp. That's so sad. Why would you do that?
Yeah. This track also contains, at the end, my favorite iteration of Percy's theme, which is the claiming soundtrack. It's all part of the same 7-minute long piece of instrumental music, and it is maximalist. It's so almost overwhelming to listen to, but I encourage you to do so.
I also wanted to talk about Kronos's theme, because this is not something I noticed when I was watching. I only learned about this from reading the blog post. Here comes another quote. Throughout the original book series, Kronos is revealed to be the ultimate threat to Percy and his friends. Kronos makes only a few appearances in this season, and they are only ever in disorienting dream sequences. We planted musical thematic seeds throughout these various dream sequences, and in the climactic showdown with Luke in the season finale. We are excited to expand these into a Kronos theme that could rival Percy's in future seasons. In addition to the ostinato and harmonic progression, audiences hear a high screeching synth drone, which uses sound design to replicate worn-out string instruments, playing off Kronos's broken and decrepit state, end quote. Our mouths are agape. Everyone on this call is, like, shocked right now.
That's such a good depiction of how music can coincide so naturally with storytelling, that Kronos in the book only appears through dreams, and he just has this omnipresent, ominous kind of position in the novels where you don't see him until later in the series, but his presence is felt. And they're literally doing that with the music subconsciously into the watcher, implanting seeds of music that they're going to recognize when Kronos comes on screen later. And they're going to be like, where did I hear that before? That's literally what the characters are experiencing. It's so cool. It's text painting. It's so cool.
The idea to use like synthetic sounding worn out string instruments for like the like decrepit decaying body of Kronos. He's unbelievable. That's the kind of thinking that wins you a Grammy Award. That's artistry.
It is true. A bad string instrument is the worst sound that you can. It is the sound of evil. They clocked it.
I also, when I read this, I made me realize that there is no Luke theme.
That's correct.
At least that gets mentioned, or that, you know, my ears didn't pick up on, which also means there's such great room to grow as far as creating a Luke theme, that not only will the Kronos theme then rival the Percy theme, but if the Luke theme can be built into the Kronos theme, or like somehow emerge out of the Kronos theme, And then we only hear it by itself, like when he dies.
Oh my God.
That would be really cool.
So cool.
I mean, it makes sense that we wouldn't have the Luke thing because we don't want to think he's that important of a character until the end of the season, but I'm sure it'll have to come up.
Yeah.
I think they'll write it for season two. That would be a great time for us to start experimenting with
electric guitars.
Should I say the electric guitar?
Oh my God, Luke has to have electric guitars.
It could be electric guitars. I could also see an argument for doing, like, if we were going to slowly transition somebody else into electric guitars, we could, like, I could also imagine Luke being synths, just like mean fat pads.
Yeah. Yes. Not to call out Charlie's dad, but Charlie's dad is a musician. He's like a bass player. It would be so cool if it was like some like deep low, like, you know, like somehow melody played on a bass.
I'm envisioning now, yeah, like a bass. And like a single like drum kit with like the brushes, you know, you know.
You know who else deserves a punk team is Talia at the end of season two. And I think maybe I love what you were just talking about, Carter. I mean, why not Talia too?
Yeah.
We need to, they both deserve it.
Season three is entirely electric guitar.
Transitioning.
Season three would be a great opportunity for Talia to have electric guitars, for Luke to like build that into all of their our campers, and then to have the hunters that be like
horns.
Flutes.
Yeah, flutes, no. Horns, forest music, but then Percy is still a French horn because he's like so annoying in book three.
the only character that stays the same. I love it. I love it.
Or we switch to a bassoon or something. Not to say bassoons are annoying. I don't mean to offend bassoonists.
Maybe I do.
Okay, this is also, I really wanted to get your guys' thoughts on this, because this is also something I did not pick up on at all. They write, quote, "The first four episodes see Percy encounter a number of monsters, from the Minotaur to the Chimera. Starting with the Fury attack at the Museum of Modern Art and the Minotaur chase in episode one, we planted the seeds of a monster theme that would be used for all of these horrific antagonists. We felt one theme would serve as a powerful reminder that all these diverse monsters were, in fact, servants of Hades, tasked with hunting down Percy and his friends. With this monstrous theme tying the variations together, we used different instrumentation to give each their own unique signature. The Minotaur was represented with low brass, Medusa with the duduk, I don't know if I'm saying that right, and a Turkish string instrument called the Yali Tanbur, again, I'm sure I mispronounced that, screeching orchestral harmonics for Echidna, and roaring horns and trumpets for the Chimera."
Can I say something that could be so out of pocket and maybe completely incorrect? I noticed this, and I wrote it in my notes, and when I listened to Olympus, maybe I'm hearing things, but I heard elements of that theme.
Stop it.
In Olympus.
That, and what that, no, that makes so much sense. I'm fully on board for that conspiracy.
Okay,
great. Because Zeus is the ultimate monster.
Thank you. No, it literally gave me chills when I noticed. Because I noticed in Minotaur, there's this like really driving kind of string moment. And I listened back and I was like, okay, that's a theme, obviously. Like that's, I hear that in other songs as well. And I thought I was hearing things when I listened immediately to Olympus. But speaking of Olympus, I mean, it's a foreboding song. It starts so dark. It's not Camp Half-Blood with like the super airy floaty harms and the sopranos and the altos and it's like dark and serious.
It is oppressive.
Yes. Oppressive is exactly the word. And like, I thought that was so telling for that to be the first introduction that we get to Olympus, but that is my secret conspiracy theory. If anyone from Sparks and Shadows is listening, I'm sorry if I totally got that wrong, but I believe it to be true.
Death of the author. Like, that's true now. It doesn't matter if they intended that. I'm accepting that now as truth.
Exactly.
I just think that idea of, like, using a common theme for all the monsters is so interesting because we are trying to debunk the idea that they are all the same within the project of the show. But at the same time, like, giving us that common thread between, like, things we're fighting against for various reasons is helpful to contextualize the world.
Yeah, I think it makes sense in the sense that the soundtrack, I guess this is something that is argued. I would say that the way that the soundtrack is functioning in these different monster scenes is to have us understand Percy's emotional landscape. And his emotional landscape at this point is this kind of generic sense of foreboding, that these are all, to an extent, interchangeable obstacles with the same source and with the same meaning for him in the moments. And I think it would be interesting if in future seasons, given that the reasoning here was very specific, they said it's because of this idea about Hades, that in future seasons, presumably we will not see the same device being used and that we will have more differentiation on the basis of like how the monsters are being understood in each conflict and what they want and where they come from and all of those things.
I thought that that was such a good point that you just made about how it's not necessarily meant to depict that all the monsters are the same, but from Percy's perspective, he's viewing them in a similar capacity. And it makes me think, you know, connecting back to our conversation about Cronus's theme, if there was that was intentional to kind of show the, you know, show Percy's belief and also show the audience that not all monsters are created equal. There are your, you know, run-of-the-mill monsters that you have to fight. And then there's Cronus. Cronus has his own theme. Cronus has his own situation going on. He is not just a monster. He is in such a different category, such a different league to some of these other obstacles that the trio are facing. And that increases, obviously, the suspense and the idea of, you know, a boss battle that is to come, you know, seasons and seasons in the future. And it just makes me think about what we were talking about earlier with this, like, unique challenge that is presented to the scoring team. You know, how can we still hold out for bigger moments later on with the music? And I think that's a good way of doing it, is kind of grouping things as one and the same and then creating space for there to be more moments down the line that are stronger than that, the ones that they're presenting right now.
And logistically, they can't write 100 unique themes. And there's the logistical aspect, but also like the theme isn't going to mean anything if we only ever hear the musical theme in one episode of the TV show and never again.
That's such a
good
point.
Music works through repetition. We need, like, the reason why we got an original theme for Cronus is because we're going to keep seeing Cronus. You know, like a theme for Ares will be used again. And through that, we'll be able to earn our dividends or, you know, reap our crops.
I would love to see if Tyson.
Oh.
I'm so curious if Tyson's musical theme will be incorporated, will incorporate the monster, like will fall under the monster category, you know, or if it does it first and then it changes, because I could see going either way, you know, like if his music does fall under the monster category, but we learn to like accept that, you know, then that's going to like, you know, subconsciously do something to our brain where we start to think, oh, we're going to associate this music with characters that are more complicated than we initially thought.
It also makes me think about Cronus's theme. And if, for example, Selena Beauregard is going to have Luke or Cronus's theme incorporated into her.
Stop it. That would be the most insane Easter egg, like spoiler, like hint at like who the spy is.
I mean, I feel like there is a music team that is capable of doing that. We've already seen the level of depth into these themes. Like, I feel like it's Sparks and Shadows and Bear McCreary. So I'm going to keep my ears peeled personally.
Oh my God. Carter, do you want to read this quote about Ares's theme?
His theme is dominated by an incessant clicking of bows against orchestral strings, a technique called collegno, meaning literally with the bow. This sound feels like a ticking time bomb, a perfect musical representation of the character's agitated aggression. We were excited to tease his theme as early as the second episode in Percy's confrontation with Clarice, Ares's daughter. We augmented Ares' theme with massive percussion in the season finale's epic showdown, resulting in one of my favorite cues of the season. Collegno is used for a number of different emotional like meanings in classical music. I do think that a lot of the time it does have this idea that it's supposed to be kind of stilted, potentially like intentionally annoying in a lot of situations. And the thing about collegno that might not be intuitive if you're not a string player is that as you're hitting the instrument with the like wooden end of the bow, like you're still putting your fingers down. Like there still is a melody that you can hear if you're listening very closely. But that's like part of the effect is that if you want to get the different pitches, you have to really strain for it. And I think that induces a certain natural psychological reaction in the listener that is part of how collegno works, does its thing. I don't know if you have any other thoughts about this technique.
That is so cool.
Yeah, I wanted you to read that quote because I didn't know how to pronounce collegno. Now I know.
I love hearing that description. It reminds me, I mean, maybe this is a very tangential comparison, but there's something about pizzicato strings that I really enjoy. And I think part of it is just the inventiveness of using a string instrument in a new novel way. I also especially love, I don't know the technical term, but when string players like hit the side of their instrument for sort of like rhythmic drum. It's interesting to me when I see things that are out of the box like that. And I love that they're incorporating elements of that into the score in really intentional ways, because Aries is nothing if not just his own thing. Like, he doesn't he doesn't play by the rules. If he was a violin player, he would find an interesting way to play the violin. You know, mm-hmm. I think it just underscores how much character is going into their decisions here. So yeah, I love that.
I think now we will go into a segment called our patron Abby asked us for our favorite tracks. So now we're going to be indulgent and talk about what our favorite tracks were. Jemiah, do you want to start? I think you listed every single song.
Oh my God. No. First of all, yes. First of all, that's my answer. I was just writing my notes, but we can pretend, yeah, all of them. I would say I have a three-way tie because I can never answer the question just clearly. I'm going to group two because they really remind me of each other. And I think I touched on this a bit earlier, and then have one live on its own. But the two that I would group together are Lord of the Dead and Auntie M. Think I'm a little biased because I heard elements in these scores that felt like they were taking from music cultures that are not just Western music. Mm-hmm. And as someone who grew up singing Carnatic music, Carnatic being South Indian classical music, it's something that I'm particularly drawn to. I love when orchestral pieces play with scales or modes that are not just like mm-hmm. the major or minor scales. And I feel like these two songs came the closest to doing that in the soundtrack. And that coupled with some of these unique choices for instruments just creates this, I like the word, otherworldly effect. And I think what happens when you, like I mentioned before, like play with modes, it just creates these emotional spaces that are not as common, I think, and really the longing, the yearning, it really comes out. And I felt like these two songs did a lot to humanize the two quote unquote monsters that are being described in these songs, Hades and Medusa. It could have been a really brash, just like, you know, a ton of harsh strings and screeching synths. But the choice to make these two songs so full of emotion and longing, I think is very telling to some of the characterization that we see in the series around Medusa and Hades and how much love and depth they are given as characters. So I really liked those two. Although I think I am a little bit biased. I especially love in Lord of the Dead, there's something I really love about a lower chorus, like bass and tenor voices. So the way that that was also incorporated, it really spoke to me. It kind of hit something in my heart very hard. And then the other song that I love, it's probably my favorite, is The Sea Does Not Like to Be Restrained. Oh my gosh, the chord progression at the beginning of this song is so unintuitive. It comes out of nowhere. And all of the suspended chords, the way that the strings are just rubbing right next to each other, it really felt magical. It transported me. I loved the horns. They sounded almost mournful. And I really got the feeling that this was written to almost sound like waves lapping against the shore. You get these, you know, a movement of sound and then it comes back. Then a movement of sound and it comes back. And I'm just a sucker for when scores paint, I'm a sucker for text painting. I'm a sucker for when scores visually represent almost in the sheet music some a phenomenon like waves, you know, hitting a shore or I just felt like that was done really well. So those are my two favorite songs.
Yeah, I'm going to echo. I think my favorite song is Auntie M because I remember distinctly the soundtrack dropped on Spotify after the first two episodes were out, but before the rest of the series was out. So I was able to listen through to all of the songs before I had associated them with scenes. And so I remember just being like, wow, like Auntie M before I had even seen episode 3 was so striking to me. And I think what you said is so true, Jemiah, that like the fact that they open up musical language that we're not used to opens up so much more feeling that we maybe aren't used to, and it like really grabs us. And I think that song is just so successful at sounding so lonely and so scary. At one moment you're feeling all empathetic and sad and like, oh, this theme is really like whoever this is sounds like their brain, I want to like reach out and hug them. And then the next second you're like, I have to back away, like this is freaky. It's just so successful at that. And I was wondering as we were doing this outline if that was because I loved episode 3 so much, but I remember that I had listened to the song before I even saw the episode. And so I think that's my favorite piece. But honorable mention to Spirit of the Sea, which I believe is what plays when Percy takes that big inhale breath at the end of episode 4, our quote mid-season finale moment, because that just like full body chills every time for the end of that piece.
I think my answer is Olympus. We talked a little bit about this in the episode where this happened, but it, I think, was the piece that stuck with me the most, where like I felt it doing so much work in a positive way the first time that we watch through this section, where like tonally there's a majesty there visually immediately, but like a lot of those opening shots in order to create that sense of majesty are really far from Percy's face. Oh. So like for us to have an emotional palette for what's happening, you really need this very like aggressive, striking sonic reminder that not necessarily like this is evil, you're about to die, but that like this is like that what you're seeing is stifling and great and overwhelming and unmoving. And there's something about the way that those chords are like you have all of these intervals that are like lockstep together, like advancing up slowly and kind of unpredictably. I just found that like horrifying, but also like very, very, very beautiful and effective at doing what it's supposed to be doing. Although my honorable mention would be for the Tunnel of Love, which I do
so think. Good. That's my second honorable mention. So good. So quirky. So Hephaestus. So uncomfy.
It's very specific. Like they really reached out and they were like, you need to understand how strange and bizarre, but also kind of like weirdly cutesy and homey this experience is going to be. Nailed it.
Absolutely. All right. I think our final segment is what are we most looking forward to hearing? We did a lot of speculating about what we're going to get for the next few seasons, but what's something you're like really excited for or like want to hear coming up?
I just love Clarice's character. I'm so excited to see Clarice get more of her flowers in season 2. I think she really strikes me as one of the most dynamic characters in the entire series and a character that just showcases immense growth. And season 2 or book 2 is such a huge moment where we get to really see inside her brain for the first time as the reader and see her and her complexity and obviously her relationship with Ares and how that, you know, affects her. And so I would love to see, I just think there's so much a score could do in showcasing these huge brash, you know, battle moments with horns and, oh my God, there's so much going on. And then stripping back and doing this a repetition of the same theme in a much more mournful, somber way when we see her maybe looking off into the distance on the ship and thinking about her relationship with her father. And then immediately the performative bringing it back into, you know, the Clarice that we know and love, letting the viewer peek behind the curtain, so to speak, musically a little bit into her brain. So that's a moment that I'm particularly very excited about. And I think this is a sillier moment, but I think we're going to get a lot of playful Grover moments, like, you know, him in the wedding dress and then the Cyclops. And I think his score can really contribute well to that. And then one last thing about Clarice, I love Dior. I actually know, like, I've met Dior and she's an angel and we support each other's music. Yes, her music is so good. And like, this is a plug to stream Dior's debut single, Focus, which is a banger. And she's so talented, so good, such a good singer. So I would love to see Clarice, I don't know, a diegetic moment perhaps in season 2 is kind of what I would love to see. So yeah,
I'm here for a musical episode. I'm so here for a musical episode. I know 90% of people aren't, but I am.
I'm so on board. Ari and Tu, we love South Asian excellence.
I'm going to go with Luke. Luke's theme is the thing I'm most excited to hear coming up and what that will entail. And like, maybe he won't even get a theme because he's just Kronos. I don't know. Like, I'm just excited to see what happens and like whatever the decision is that they make for Luke, because we don't have that sonic landscape yet. And it should be electric guitars.
I'm excited for the new instrumentation to go with all of the new and returning characters that we're going to meet. Yeah. And specifically, I am excited for a whole season of new musical ideas about how to capture the ocean and different angles on the ocean.
Yes.
Ocean music is very important. And I know that we're in good hands for that.
We're just so excited for the ocean season made by these people who know a lot about pirates.
Yeah.
It's going to go so well.
Exactly.
All right, that brings us to the end of our conversation. This is everything I dreamed of, and that means it's time for Jemiah to promote and plug. And also, you should tell us about your dream, like your greatest dream as a songwriter.
I'm gonna cry. Thank you so much, first of all. Thank you for just the most wonderful conversation I could have ever imagined. Again, I've said it now for the third time, my favorite things ever are music and Percy Jackson. So to meld those two things into one conversation, I am very, very happy about. I would be remiss to not share my dream. I was telling Erica and Carter about this earlier, but when music first started to take off for me on social media and I moved to LA and I started working with my current management team, my manager asked me, you know, every artist has their big dream. For some, it's winning a Grammy. For some, it's, you know, selling out Madison Square Garden. What is your big dream? And I kid you not, at that point, I didn't even know that an official Percy Jackson adaptation was in the works. But I said, one day, I hope Percy Jackson will get adapted and that I will get to work on the music for whatever that adaptation is. That has literally been my dream for my entire life. And I know this is now uncomfortable self-promotion time, but if anybody who's working on the show happens to be listening to this, I'm a singer-songwriter. I have accumulated around 50 million streams on my original music over the last few years.
That's insane.
Thank you.
Those numbers are truly wild. Yeah.
Means the world to me. Thank you so much. And my music has been highlighted by organizations like the Recording Academy. I was on the Grammys list of artists to watch last year, on Emmy's list of artists to watch. And I currently, obviously, am developing my own artist project. I have a concept album inspired by Greco-Roman mythology coming this year. But on top of that, I write for music, film, and theater. I have projects and work with Disney, Universal Pictures, and I work with Warner Brothers Pictures as well. So all of the things, and it would be just a dream come true to be in the same room when the music and magic is being made. And that's it. And thank you for
that, guys. Yay, pitching. That's so important.
And also hire Erica and Carter, too.
Yeah. Disney, you know where to find us. Put us on your payroll. We're out here.
I support this very, very much.
All right. Well, everybody, make sure that you follow Jemiah on the internet. We'll have it all linked in our show notes, Twitter, Instagram, etc. Spotify, listen to Dior's single. We'll have that link too. And yeah, follow our show. If you're listening right now and you don't follow us on social media, make sure you give us a follow. It helps us out. And we will see y'all next time for some more exciting interviews coming up. Bye, y'all.
Bye, y'all.